The following programming is sponsored by Clean and Sober Media. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
If you need immediate help, please call the National Substance Abuse and Mental Health Hotline at 1-800-662-HELP. Welcome to Clean and Sober Radio, brought to you in part by Jefferson University Hospitals and Thomas Jefferson University, providing excellent clinical and compassionate care in the Philadelphia region, a proven leader in healthcare and education since 1825, and Acadia Healthcare, with locations on the East Coast. Acadia maintains a standard for excellence in the treatment of behavioral health and addiction concerns. And now, here are your hosts, Gary Hendler and Mark Sigmund.
Hey, thanks everybody for joining us and welcome to the show. Clean and Sober Radio features real people with real stories about addiction to drugs and alcohol. Mark, what's new this week in recovery news?
So the new diabetes and weight loss drug, Ozempic, which is usually given once a week by injection, could help curb addictive habits. People on the drug are reporting not getting the same thrill after starting the drug and being able to moderate drinking. Scientists say drugs similar to Ozempic could be rewiring the reward pathways of the brain, leading to reducing the brain's pleasurable chemical dopamine from being released from addictive substances. More research is needed.
Well, let me tell you something. The problem with that is the people that need this a drug for diabetes, they're having trouble now getting the medication because there's so many people are using it for other ailments.
Yes, and they're looking into researching this for things like Alzheimer's and other diseases. So it's an interesting area. I'm always skeptical when you hear about a drug that allows you to moderate because you know us. We'll find a way to abuse something, whether it's switching or, you know, that kind of thing. But it is interesting that people are reporting this. Again, more research is needed and studies will be
needed
to back
it
up.
What else you got?
So the zombie drug xylazine has claimed its first victim in the UK and could be in widespread use across the country. The death of 40-year-old Carl Warburton last May marked the first recorded fatality caused by xylazine, a powerful sedative which has devastated cities across the United States. Experts now believe, as of this May, that the drug, nicknamed Trank, could be widespread in British heroin supply. So this stuff is spreading. You know,
well, that is some scary stuff. I mean, you've reported on it, amputation, I mean, mutilation of the skin.
Yeah, and for people that aren't familiar, it's basically used as an animal tranquilizer, and now it's mixed with fentanyl. And, I mean, could it get any worse?
Listen, you know, people who have no connection to addiction say to themselves, if this is what happens, why would anybody use it?
I know. And the thing is that, you know, if somebody's addicted, they're usually, everybody knows this, they run for the most strong stuff they could possibly find.
Yeah, absolutely. We know that when somebody overdoses, they want to know where the cop man is who sold that poison to somebody. Listen, we're going to take our first break. When we come back, we have board-certified psychiatrist Charles Trigiani is going to be with us. And I have a question to ask him. Does anybody really know what causes addiction? Don't go away. We'll be right back.
This is Clean and Sober Radio.
Any luck?
A cancer diagnosis can knock the wind out of you. The Sidney Kimmel Cancer Center at Abington Jefferson Health can help. Our brand new Asplund Cancer Pavilion brings you 86,000 square feet of cancer-fighting science for truly comprehensive care. Backed by the strength of an NCI-designated cancer center. Call 1-800-JEFF-NOW. The Sidney Kimmel Cancer Center at Abington Jefferson Health. The power to out-science cancer.
What's happening? Brandon Novak here from Those Movies Jacks, or author of that addiction memoir, Dream Seller. Do me a favor and tune into Clean and Sober Radio with Gary Hendler.
888-728-9941. This is Clean and Sober Radio.
You WPEN 97.5 HD2 out of Philadelphia, WWWE out of Atlanta, Georgia, WHFS Tampa, Florida, WGAC in Augusta, Georgia. All right, we're back. Dr. Trigiani, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And, you know, it's I want to be completely open and transparent. So a doctor and I went to high school together. We hadn't seen each other in – we graduated high school – was it 20 years ago?
10
years ago. And I saw him and we start talking.
Wow.
And he was telling me he's a psychiatrist and he's dealt with addiction. I said, yeah, you got to come on the show because, you know – first of all, I don't think we've had a psychiatrist on this show, and we can get a lot of answers. You know, at least we can get a lot of subjects brought up and discussed, and our audience can maybe get some answers to some questions. So, doctor, that's why you're here, man. Thanks for coming on the show. So let's talk about, first of all, you're a psychiatrist.
Right.
Not to be confused. I'm not putting anybody down to a psychologist. I think a lot of people mix up those two terms. A psychiatrist, as you are, had to go to medical school first.
Correct.
Yeah.
So you have to go to medical school, do an internship, and then, in my case, a three-year residency, and then you can be a psychiatrist. You prescribe medications.
Right. And a psychologist goes to school to be a psychologist, cannot prescribe medication, and doesn't know the body like you know. I don't know how else to say it.
Psychologists are really smarter than psychiatrists. That's a shout out to all my psychologists
that are listening, right?
No, really. Psychologists are really bright folks, and they are, you know, real helpers. And they have, like, great specialized knowledge in a variety of psychological areas. Some interested in biofeedback, others do psychotherapy, others are more, some are medication oriented and can prescribe medications in some states. So there's a whole, you know, there's a whole dearth of psychology that's underutilized, unfortunately.
Doc, do you think addiction is genetic, environmental? Does anybody really know? I know you know how to treat it, but does anybody know the root of it?
I'm not sure anybody really knows the root of addiction. I mean, the brain was not designed to handle the kinds of stimulation that drugs can offer. I mean, yeah, you know, prior to the development of, like, let's go back to not caveman, but let's just go far back for a bit. You know, the stimulants, what would stimulate the brain would be the wind, the weather, the storms. You could be scared of an animal. You could be, perhaps afraid of another person. You could have an interaction. You could even go to war and, you know, be very alert. And even in a situation where your life is threatened, that doesn't hold a candle to what these drugs can do. These drugs will really blow out your dopamine centers. I mean, the brain was not evolved to handle, you know, methamphetamines and cocaine and ecstasy and even the opiates, the powerful opiates, you know, heroin. It was never – we are not evolutionarily, we never made it there. So it becomes – it's really overwhelming for our brains to take on drugs.
You know, the timeline of how long we have been on this earth is, I don't know, millions of years. Why do you think in the last – look, I used to hear stories in the 50s, the entertainers would be using drugs, and I'm sure some drugs would be used. Why do you think in the last 50 years – this has taken over the society in some way? Well, why in just 50 years, out of all the years, I wonder what it is. The psyche of human beings is that draws us to try to get out of where we are.
Yeah, that's
great.
That's a tough question. I'm not sure it's a psych, psychiatrist could answer that. You know, I mean, that's more of a philosophical question, you know, a theological question.
Yeah, yeah, I know.
An anthropological question, you know, but, I mean.
It's weird. So
it's very difficult to know for sure why. I mean, we have, in 50 years, we have done so much technologically that we're probably not ready for either.
Yeah.
You know?
And Doc, what are you thinking in another 50 or 100 years? I always ask this question about people's professions. This will seem primitive, won't it? How we're treating addiction.
I hope so.
Yeah.
Yeah, me too.
Right?
Yeah,
I hope so. I hope that there are some real breakthroughs in medicine that allow us to be more specific about all kinds of illnesses. And that's happening with cancer.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, immunotherapy and there's some really specific therapies for folks. But substance abuse is a tough one.
Yeah, yeah.
You go back. If you go way back, I bet you, you know, like folks that like we're talking, I don't know, way before the technological era, were probably brewing beer, wine. I mean, it goes back. How far?
But
that goes way back.
I know it goes back. Really,
probably even the cavemen. You know?
Cavemen. But the intensity of it. I know that the amount of product was never there. The pharmaceutical, that wasn't back. You know, it was alcohol. It was peyote. It was who knows what. But
you knew what you were taking. You know, even 50 years ago, people knew what they were buying. But now they don't. And you have no idea what you're getting when you purchase something from someone on the street or a dealer of some substance.
Right.
It's supposed to be, you give it a new name, you call it ecstasy. You know, well, it's not ecstasy. You know, it's something else.
It's and fentanyl or?
So, you know, to find out what it is, you know, you would need to do a melting point. Do you know about melting points?
I don't. Do you, Mark?
I do not know about melting
okay,
points.
Okay, so melting points. So there's this machine, right? So you can chemists know about it. And you take a little pipette and you tap the pipette into whatever the substance
is. What's a pipette?
Pipette, I'm sorry, a little glass tube, like a straw.
Oh, okay.
A tiny little straw.
Okay,
a tiny little straw, excuse me.
Yeah.
And you put it into this machine and it has like, it's like looking into a microscope. Okay, it really is. And you see the end of this pipette or the end of this glass straw with the substance in it, and it has temperatures, and you increase the temperature, and as you increase the temperature, things melt. Everything on this planet melts at a specific temperature. Salt melts at a specific temperature. Iron melts at a specific temperature. Aluminum, it doesn't, whatever you, sugar melts at all molecules will melt at a specific temperature. Methamphetamine melts at a specific temperature, right? Tricyclics melt at another temperature. So you can identify specifically what drug is there by melting, by putting it into a melting machine and determine a melting point. So as you turn up the temperature, different parts of the straw will start to melt, and you can see what the temperature is, and you can write down, okay, that substance melted at this temperature, this melted at that temperature. You find out there's 4 or 5 different melting points. You look them up in a book, and the book will tell you that that's what's really in there. And that's kind of what needs to happen these days. I mean, it's almost like, you know, it's really risky to not know what you're taking in and to trust people that are selling you drugs because they're making money. It's really dangerous.
Hundreds of thousands of people a year are dead because of the result of exactly what you're talking about. If you're just joining us now, we're talking with board-certified psychiatrist Charles Trigiani, and we're going to get some answers today about a lot of questions that, you know, we don't know the answers to, and I'm hoping that the doc can give us some answers. Some of these questions are non-answerable, if that's a word.
Yeah, I've actually been looking forward to this because, you know, we know about the brain, and you know, like you said, that the strength of these things these days, do you think that has really contributed to this? You know, in other words, 50 years ago, you didn't have fentanyl around and you didn't have some of these strong pharmaceuticals around, do you think that maybe that has contributed to the increase?
Yes. The strength of the drugs and the not knowing what the drugs are and the willingness to take them despite all that. And where's the willingness to take these drugs coming from?
Doc, you know, we talk about addiction goes hand in hand many times with mental illness. Do you see your patients either they have – I hate to use the word mentally ill – that are mentally ill that have addiction issues, or do you get people who come to you with addiction but really it's a manifestation from mental illness?
I see both.
Both.
Yeah. I see folks that, you know, don't – who use drugs partly as self-medication. You know, we've all seen that.
Yeah.
You know, some folks suffer with schizophrenia and they'll smoke a lot of cigarettes and the tobacco, the nicotine in the cigarette is, how to explain it? It affects the gating phenomenon in the brain. Gating is like an awareness. It's connected to awareness. So a lot of times schizophrenics are distracted by a lot of the noises and extraneous sounds and they really can't focus. So if they smoke a lot of cigarettes, the nicotine helps them focus better. So it's sort of a self-medicating way of holding on to reality. And, you know, not all of reality, just some of the attentional part of reality. So that's an example of, you know, self-medicating that's not normally thought about.
You know, your profession, it must be very rewarding, but it's a difficult – another medical – somebody – an orthopedic surgeon breaks – somebody comes in, they have a broken leg or whatever – that can be fixed, man. Boom, boom, boom. But when you're dealing with the brain, I wonder what percentage does the medical profession actually know? What percentage they really know about the brain? That is so complicated, Doc. I mean, even the information you're giving us now, you've had a study and study and study. I'm always amazed at this because a doctor that deals with the brain. Very simply, he's a smart guy.
Yeah, and you know, they say, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that we only know about, what is it, 5 or 10% about the brain? Is that still the going?
It's like that movie Lucy, you know, 10% of the brain and 20% and 30% yeah. And she has 100%. It's a great movie. I actually think that people use their full mental capacity. I think people are at 100%. I think people use everything.
But is your 100% my 100%?
I doubt it.
You
to look at this.
Between the two of us.
I know.
Doc has
a game changer.
We might have 100%, but he's got it in his own head.
He's running on all cylinders.
That's right.
To be a psychiatrist. I can tell you
right?
That. Yes.
So it's nice to think of me as being super intelligent then. It gives you a sense of comfort.
Well, you are, yeah.
But I mean, really, I think that's a normal reaction. Like for folks, I think sometimes want to see their docs as being real smart. And I think you do need to know your business. You do need to know in any you know, any profession. You need to know what you're doing. But it's particularly important when, you know, you personally have a problem and you're with your physician and you'd like to feel that your doc is top shelf and really knows his stuff and you can really trust what they're saying. So and I appreciate that. So,
no,
you may be giving me a little more accolades than I, you know, really deserve.
Well,
I don't think I'm any smarter than you guys.
Listen,
that way. I think you're both pretty
Mark,
bright.
We're doing that because we hope you'll come back on the show.
Oh, yes, right? Absolutely.
There you go.
You know, backing up a little bit on this whole, we call it dual diagnosis, you know, where you have a substance thing and then you also have a mental health issue. One of the things that really throws shade in the water, I'll give you an example. I just recently worked with somebody. They came in full-blown, psychosis was going on, right?
Right, right.
And this person, I was able to treat them over a two-month period without medications.
Right.
And the psychosis went away.
Good.
And they were using Coke for, you know, every day for the longest time. But I've seen sometimes where they're throwing a lot of medications at them, you know? And it's so hard to tell, isn't it? Like, is it caused by the drug, some of these things with addicts?
You mean the when a person is being medicated for like a psychosis,
yeah.
Could the medication that the psychosis that we're using to treat the psychosis cause them to be worse?
Well, in other words, like sometimes people will be put on, I've seen, you know, antipsychotics, and they really don't need them because after, you know, 2 months, it was drug-induced, the psychosis.
Yes, generally that's a short-term use of an antipsychotic, you know. I mean, in general, but
yeah.
So the question is, you know, can people do some of this or, you know, a fair amount of this without medications? Like, what happens if we didn't use medications?
In certain situations.
In certain situations. Yeah. I mean, there's probably not enough real good diagnosis going on. I'm not sure if you're aware of the problem with diagnosis, but what happened with diagnosis was that, it became like the insurance companies would only pay for certain diagnoses. Like they wouldn't pay for conduct disorder. They wouldn't pay for, what won't they pay for? There's a number of diagnoses that insurance companies really won't pay for. So patients would come in and they would find out that you know, like personality disorders, which can be really debilitating, or a lower level of depression, dysthymic disorder, or certain obsessive personalities, or there's a variety of lot of different diagnoses out there. So they stop paying. And so what would they pay for? They would pay for bipolar. They'll pay for depression. So, of course, it changed the marketplace so the diagnosis shifted to meet the payment of the insurance. So, you know, so you end up with this, like, loss of honest diagnostic push, you know, and then what happens is that, you're not going to get as definitive a treatment as I think you would like. So it's there's a system out there that you have to deal with when you're, you know, in a situation. And if you don't act in accordance with what standard of care, then, you know, you could be liable.
So there's this conflict or whatever between business and standard care, as the doc said, and it's, I guess it's sort of a balancing act. I mean, unfortunately, you know.
It started way back in the analytic days before medications really took hold. So folks would go to a psychoanalytic hospital and then they would, you know, they would get the treatment and another hospital, then medications came into play, antidepressants. And they would go. They would leave the psychoanalytic hospital, go to the where they stayed 6 months. Then they go to a hospital that gave medications, and they'd be better in 10 days. Mm. And then they said, "Well, why are you doing? Like, what's this psychoanalysis?" So they stopped the psychoanalysis, and they went all to medications. They threw the baby out with the bathwater. Mm-hmm. So now psychoanalysis has been relegated. Not, I don't mean this in a bad way, but, you know, lay folks now do psychoanalysis, and so they should. And, you know, somebody who's really drawn to psychoanalysis should do it. But we've lost that too. We've lost that whole diagnostic capacity of being able to really understand people. You know, it's.
I get it. Yeah, a number here if you want to get involved, get into the conversation is 1-888-728-9941. That's 1-888-728-9941. And here's your opportunity when we come back to speak with Dr. Charles Trigiani. Get some of your questions answered.
This is Clean and Sober Radio.
Huntington Creek Recovery Center is Eastern Pennsylvania's premier provider of transformative care for individuals whose lives have been impacted by addiction. Our 40-acre campus offers a tranquil, recovery-focused environment. We specialize in evidence-based care that addresses the effects of trauma and offer a unique program specifically for adolescent males. Huntington Creek Recovery Center can help you achieve lasting sobriety. Call us today at 844-948-2320.
Hi, I'm Tony Luke Jr., and I listen to Clean and Sober Radio.
888-728-9941. This is Clean and Sober Radio.
Hey, if you're just listening to us around the country, you can actually watch us right now. Go to the Facebook and go to our Facebook page, Clean and Sober Radio, and you can watch us do the show. It's a lot of fun, just like these folks. Laura Story, Bill Stahl, Debbie Reynolds, Bill Schiffman. They're just some of our audience right now that are actually watching us. And, of course, they're listening if they're watching. But it's you can see what goes on when we do this show. And
see the craziness, right?
See the sometimes it gets crazy in here, doesn't it?
It does get crazy in here sometimes. You
but,
know?
You know, Mark, we always say this, don't we? This is a serious subject, but we have fun doing it.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. And it's just so cool to get some of this knowledge, you know, to see it from this point of view. It's just great having you on the show.
Thank you.
And will you commit right now, Mark, to having electric shock treatment?
Well, that's the crazy thing. We were talking before the show, and I know we're going to get into it.
Yeah.
I would be very interested in trying electric shock therapy.
Listen, I'm a lay person. I'm not a doctor, but I think you should consider it.
I would only do it with you. And, you know, where we would go together.
Yeah, let's do this. Let's have Brad do it first.
Yeah. Well, let's set aside an afternoon. And but in all seriousness, I've heard really
good stuff
about it. You know, that it really helps.
Yeah. Doc, how does it – somebody – obviously, you're their doctor, and you make a diagnosis at electric shock treatment, or you call it ECT. Is that what you call it?
Yes.
Would be a good thing for this patient. So they come in. Is it like a surgery? I mean, do they can't eat the night before? Do they come in? They change their clothes into a gown and they lay down, right?
No gown.
Okay.
But similar to like what you would experience with a colonoscopy. I mean, in a sense, it's a very, you know, brief procedure that, you know, lasts maybe 15, 20 minutes, the whole an hour to completely recover. But it's very fast. I mean, you know, you're talking about 5 minutes for the procedure.
Are there... When you're done with it, does the person have a headache?
Sometimes. I mean, you know, we try to prevent that. We have different medicines we can use to prevent a headache, starting with Tylenol.
And what kind of addiction would you think – and this is a broad spectrum question, really. Yeah. Is this treatment good for addiction?
You know, that's a complicated – if someone has a really bad reaction to drugs and they're in a delirium and or having a psychosis from ecstasy and they're in a hospital setting, like a real hospital setting, like with, you know, ICUs and folks like that, I mean, where you're really in a situation where you could manage – delirium is a really dangerous thing to have. Mm-hmm. It's very dangerous. But if you have a withdrawal psychosis from a drug, ECT can treat that. From amphetamines, LSD, ecstasy. And if, like I said earlier, you know, you're probably not getting ecstasy or amphetamines or LSD when you think you're taking those things. You're taking five other compounds, and maybe there isn't even any amphetamine in there. But the psychosis, nonetheless, will still respond to ECT. I'm not in a situation where I'm taking on that level of ECT at this time. Right. I mean, that's a pretty... That's more intense than we can manage.
Electric shock treatment has a stigma like addiction. I mean, the old horror movies that we would see, Twilight Zone. I mean, just crazy stuff. Does that affect your industry? The stigma of the old black and white movies, where somebody would be shocked and they'd be bouncing off the table, and luckily we know that it is really. Can be very, very successful.
I saw a patient's father today who was telling me that he went on his computer and did GDB, and you know, it was recommended to a family member that person get ECT, and when he read the ChatGPT, he was like, oh my God! Why did I do this a year ago when it was told? Like, this is really good stuff, and you know it's very effective. It's safe. And it's really for major depressive disorder. But this is for folks that are pretty, you know, that are really struggling, oftentimes have failed medications. And
right. I was going to ask you, after a failed medication, right?
But the interesting part of ECT, to me, like one of the most, so for me, one of the most interesting things are the history. So it goes back to a guy named Maduna. This guy Maduna was, I guess he was around 1934 when he noticed, and this he worked with cadaver brains, okay, people that were deceased, and he had their brains. And he noticed that people with epilepsies, their brains were heavier than the brains of schizophrenics. And he wondered why that is. And he studied it and figured out that the glial cells, there were more glial cells in the epileptics than in the schizophrenic brain. So he started saying, well, geez, you know, why don't we give convulsions to schizophrenics and maybe their symptoms will go away? Because look what it did. It made the, you know, epileptic brains better. So maybe you could, so we'll give convulsions to the schizophrenic patients. And back then they didn't really call it schizophrenia, probably. I mean, they may have called it schizophrenia. But it, so they did, but they used chemicals when they first started, which was an unpredictable way of doing it. And by 1940-ish, they were able to use electricity. But it did help. I mean, it cleared the back wards in the late 30s. The back wards in the state hospitals went from reduced the population of those wards 50%.
Wow.
So it really was effective, you know, back in like the 40s. And then it got some bad press. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, that's been a stain on this very good treatment for a long time.
So this treatment is acceptable in the medical community. It's not really mainstream acceptable, is it?
I know what you're saying. Yeah. I mean, no, I think I don't think it is in the way it should be.
Right,
or it
right,
could be,
right.
You know, because it really has a profound effect. I mean, someone who is severely depressed, right, has about a – if you take an antidepressant, you know, you're going to get 60 to 70% of those people are going to get better. Now, if you take the remaining 30%, 20 to 30% that don't get better, right, ECT is going to clear 70% of those.
Wow.
Right.
Wow.
Now, if you take somebody that's can't do this in this kind, in England, you can. So in England, if you have a severe depression and you say, look, I don't want to wait for medications. I just want to get treatment. I'm really depressed. I got to get back to work. I got a family. You know, you could get treatment with ECT and 90% effective.
Wow.
With
that's
people that don't use medicines.
Yeah.
If you looked at any, you know, any treatment, that's.
You know, I think your profession should have a PR firm, some kind of information that gets out there that shows people this is not scary, you're not going to die, this works. I don't think that the promotion on this, if you want to say it, is out there. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. And
the PR on it is I think most people still think, I mean, people naive like I am, of the horrors of it, when it's absolutely what I hear from Doc, and I've heard from a lot of medical people, this stuff really can save basically your life, your lifestyle at least.
Yeah, and you know, we get people as a counselor, I see them with this treatment-resistant depression,
right?
You know, where like they've tried the SSRIs, they've tried the SNRIs, they've tried all these things, and they're not getting better.
Now, there's transmagnetic stimulation. That's another new one that's out there that's using a magnet to treat the depression, and that's pretty effective. Now, there's these ketamine clinics, and you've probably heard of those. So that's another one that's, you know, and ketamine, you know, can offer you promise if you're depressed. You know, you can. And there's different approaches to using ketamine, and I'm not a ketamine expert. there are studies that, you know, will look at ketamine compared to placebo, you know, and in a month you might not see much of a difference.
Does insurance pay for this?
It does.
Now, I guess what we get into is that somebody has to fail at the other options. That was interesting what you said about over in Europe and someplace.
You mean for like –
To get ECT.
To get ECT. Sometimes an insurance company will – they'll be okay with it. You know, if the severity is really there and – you know, we will communicate directly and say, look, we please help us here.
Dr. Trigiani, let me ask you a question. Would this be a helpful treatment for, let's just say somebody has been on heroin for 10 years and can't get off? Can it be used in this kind of way in the addiction community?
Technically, no. But
if it treats the depression.
If you're clinically depressed, then it can definitely help the depression. And if you're clinically depressed and you're using heroin, that's a problem, because you're going to have – it's going to be much harder for you to find a pathway to sobriety.
But if you – what I'm hearing is if you treat somebody with severe depression and their depression before this had led to their addiction, that would work, wouldn't it?
Well, addiction takes on its own life,
But if I'm depressed or I'm whatever it is and I'm taking pills or whatever because I feel so crappy about myself, if you could get rid of my depression, would that necessarily
– This is the old
– I have no idea what I'm saying.
There was
old debate.
Debate. Okay. Yeah. It used to be that if a patient was struggling with depression and they were drinking, there was a time when psychiatrists would not treat that patient. That changed, okay? Mm-hmm. So people said, you need to treat patients who suffer with depression and are drinking. And what happened as a result of that was that folks that were depressed, that were drinking, got antidepressants and they improved and they were able to cut back significantly or stop their substance abuse issue. And they were able to attain sobriety much easier. Now, to go to the whole level of ECT that's a whole nother – there might be some research on that, but
– It's fascinating.
It is fascinating. I'm really into this now.
I am too. And the fascinating part is I've always been sort of taught as a clinician that like somebody has to stop before you can – because the medications, you've combined them with alcohol and things like that. But that's not really the case, huh? Like you don't necessarily have to stop first to be
not
treated.
For antidepressants, no.
Okay.
Okay. If someone is really like deeply entrenched, I don't want to say pickled, but that's if they're really deep into alcohol and they're withdrawing, ECT is not going to be appropriate. You really have to get a person, at least detoxed first. Do a detox, give them a chance to see what baseline looks like, and then you can determine from there.
Yeah. Hey, if you're listening, you're just joining us right now, we're talking to a board certified psychiatrist, Dr. Charles Trigiani. Call us if you want some of your questions answered, because I know our audience – I know you're sitting there behind your – whatever you're behind and you have questions. So call us 1-888-728-9941. And if you are in need of help right now, please call the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Hotline at 1-800-662-HELP. That's 1-800-662-HELP. And we had some people jumping on right now. Betsy Green says, great show and a wonderful guest. That's dynamite. Nancy Minnick is watching. Very informative show. Couldn't agree with you more. Vince Leone is watching. TJ Gleason. Neil Thatcher is watching. Or Boos Rahim is watching. I hope I didn't put – God, I butchered it. Laura Story. Hey, guys. My nephew just had a hold on him, 72-hour hold. He broke out all the windows in his mother's house, which he – let me see where I am here. All the windows in his mother's – which he was living in – and was on coke, long-time trauma. He threatened everybody, grandmother, father, uncle, went to court, had the judge commit him for 72 hours, long-time drug abuse. Ask the doctor any advice on what to do after the 72 hours is up and you're released from a psychiatric facility. Any suggestions, Doc?
this is, very complicated.
Yeah.
if a person is released after 72 hours, then technically they're no longer a danger to themselves and others. So yeah. maybe they were, you know, and that is such a super complicated issue. I mean,
yeah,
I don't know how to. Yeah. I would need a little more specific information. Yeah. But in dealing with the 72 hour issue, I mean, I think it's important for, I guess for folks maybe to understand how difficult it is to really treat, you know, others. I mean, from the psychiatric perspective, you know, people have rights and they have the right to refuse medication and they, you know, they have the right to an attorney. They have a right to leave a hospital. They have a right not to be confined. And I think there's the concept, you know, that folks, when they're treated, you don't want someone confined against their will, but you don't want them to hurt yourself either. So there's this delicate balance that you have to strike with that. So that 72-hour notice is kind of like a safety net for that the law basically offers medicine to sort of give folks a chance to like cool off and make sure that this is they're going to be okay, that they can control themselves.
I mean, your specialty is so complicated. I mean, again, I'm going to go back to somebody breaks their leg. Everybody's leg, the bones look pretty much the same. But with the brain, it has to be so customized, the treatment, right? I mean, one brain does not fit all. You know what I mean? I mean, compared to the rest of your body, where everybody pretty much looks the same, the brain is different. Is that sort of right? Yeah.
If we go to sci-fi for a second,
and
we were to swap bodies,
yeah,
right,
yeah,
would you have a different experience in my body when I have a different experience in your body, like just right here and right now, boom, like you're me and I'm you, right? If we could swap,
we could.
Somehow,
I'd become.
Right? I think would be
take that.
I don't think that the experience would be that different.
But no,
I don't think it's. I don't. You know what I'm saying? I don't think that when you're talking about the brain, I'm talking about the mind. So they're sort of. Different.
If I have depression and Mark has depression,
yeah,
are we treated exactly the same?
Well, if you broke your arm,
yeah.
right,
yeah,
and Mark broke his arm,
right,
same exact break,
yeah,
would your arms be treated the same?
Well.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Like, I don't know.
I think people want to be unique. And I think that's one of the cool things about being human is that everybody wants to be unique. But I don't think there's such a great uniqueness. But I think we're all the same.
Even in the brain?
Even in the brain.
That's interesting. Okay, yeah. That's a question I've often wondered. And I'm glad we got an answer to that.
Yeah, and I guess – but certainly certain people react differently to certain drugs, right? Like you hear somebody that has ADHD – and they get calm on stimulants, whereas right. somebody that doesn't will get hyper on stimulants.
That's right.
I mean, you see that, I guess.
Right. So there's, you know, there are some. There's definitely going to be a variation. I mean, I think if, how can I put this? There are problems with some brains. Okay, some people have. Imperfections in their brain. They have abnormalities in their brain. Sometimes it's very subtle. Sometimes it just affects the chemical density of like, you know, like the relative densities of different chemicals in the brain and some people have problems with their, like Einstein, what his left temporal lobe was huge. Right? I mean, you know, just phenomenally. It was big at autopsy. It was gigantic. Some people are going to have bigger hippocampus, better memory. Some people are going to have bigger frontal lobes, maybe better judgment. Some people are going to have smaller frontal lobes, not such great judgment. Some people are going to have, you know what I mean, really good parietal lobes, and their ability for movement is better. So there's going to be variations in the brain that's going to cause individuals to be stronger or weaker in different functionality.
Yeah, this is so interesting. I'm learning so much, and I'm sure our audience is learning a lot. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk more about this subject. fascinating.
This is Clean and Sober Radio.
Diversity in the workplace is more than gender, ethnicity, and even age. It also means people in recovery. The Higher Calling Foundation works to end the stigma of substance use disorders in the workplace by helping those in recovery find jobs, get career counseling, and more. All things insurance doesn't cover, and all at no cost. And encouraging businesses to hire employees in recovery, because with the Great Resignation, there are jobs to be filled, and employees in recovery are an untapped demographic. It's mutually beneficial, and it's simply good business. Started by employment attorney in recovery Kevin Heyer, the Higher Calling Foundation believes everyone deserves a second chance and works to make that happen. And now, diversity in the workplace demands it. Visit HigherCalling.org. That's HYERCalling.org. And find out how we can help you.
Hi, this is Dion, the Wanderer. Listen to Clean and Sober Radio. You might hear something that'll change your life. Yo!
888-728-9941. This is Clean and Sober Radio.
I got to tell you something, Mark. This is one of the shows that I'm learning the most. And, you know, it's serious, but we're still having fun. But the doc here is really clearing up a lot of questions that I had or that I was, you know, I've been wondering about.
Yeah, me too. And you know, for people that are struggling with treatment-resistant depression and they're in recovery, right? I mean, this whole ECT, electroconvulsive therapy, is not talked about much, and it's very effective.
It needs a PR firm.
Absolutely.
To get it out there, you know? And listen, I got to just – a lot of people are watching this thing, and I just want to hit a couple more. Bahalu Fiaz is watching. Troy Kiernan is watching. Michelle Hofstetter. Laura Flick, love this talk. Vince Leone, the most successful treatment for dual diagnosis is the combination of medical treatment and psychotherapy. Chuck will certainly agree. When he says Chuck, he means Dr. Trigiani. Laura Flick is watching. Yeah, look, I think this is great.
It really is, and you know, your colleague, I guess, asked that question. I guess it is, right? It's the combination. You need the medicine if you're struggling with a mental health issue or medical treatment along with the counseling at the same time. That's the best.
It's a shame when you don't get both, you know, or you just get one or the other. And I think things have moved into that model now. It used to be that one person would do both, like – you know, psychiatrists used to be able to do the medication and do the treatment. I had a practice that was so, you know, much fun back in the old days, you know, before managed care, where, you know, like let's say the parent brings the child in for treatment and the kid's acting out. So, you know, you sit down for 15, 20 minutes and you realize pretty quickly that, well, the child's acting out because these two, they're going to get divorced, the parent. So eventually, you know, a few sessions, you say to the kid, you know, get out of here. You don't need to be you don't need to be here. Okay, I'll call you if I need you again. You parents, you sit down and you be here. You be part of this treatment. I need to treat. And the kid is like, thank God somebody saw that my parents are really the problem. You know, and the kid's behavior calms right down. So being able to do that kind of thing is tough today in this day and age, because it's all divided now. So you have, you know, the psychiatrist has been shoved to the corner of psychopharmacology. So we give medications and we write prescriptions. And, you know, psychologists and social workers and therapists end up, you know, doing, you know, in some ways, you know, the real work. And it saddens me when I see that, you know, psychiatrists are just prescribing medications. Because some, you know, this whole concept that for every twisted thought, there's a twisted molecule. You know, that's what it used. That's how psychopharm came into being. Was like, well, we're going to find whatever's wrong with you. We have a pharmacological answer for it. And I think that partly answers the why in the last 50 years, because people want a quick fix. People want a drug. People want to feel better. And, you know, who wants to work for something? I mean, if you could take a pill, right, and feel better.
Yeah.
Right? Aren't you going to do that? I mean,
oh, I did.
So
me too.
But You know, yeah. So, but the combination, you know, of psychotherapy and medication is really, I mean, how do you just treat people with medication only and not, you have to make some behavioral changes. I mean, everybody needs to make some behavioral changes.
You know, that leads me into this, you know, we get into recovery, our community, and we go to meetings, okay, hopefully. But, you know, there's such – and meetings are great. They're great, great, great. But if you have the opportunity and the luxury of getting into treatment with a psychologist or a psychiatrist, it just gives you more not guarantee, but it makes it your journey is going to be more successful, I think, in some cases. You know, the more stuff that you can do to help yourself – I think it's, you know, that's what you should do. And certainly therapy. Look, I've been in therapy my whole life, all right? You wouldn't know it.
When you were born, you came out and started the therapy?
No, my parents waited until I was 2 years old.
2 years old?
Yeah. but seriously, the more ammunition or whatever that you can do to help yourself, you know, the luckier you are. And therapy is a wonderful, wonderful thing, and the stigma of, you know, if you're weak, if you have to go in therapy, is such crap. Yeah. It's not even funny. It's you are strong if you go to therapy.
Well, and you know, it's important for all of us in recovery to know too that there's some things where we may need outside help.
Yeah.
You know, there's been suicides where, you know, somebody wasn't going to get outside help and needed it, you know, and they were staying clean. So it's just important that we know that sometimes we may need this outside help, right?
Yeah. And I would just hope that the medical community would understand what the doctor said. Don't just prescribe pills. And also they would understand that, you know, where people with addiction can get treatment. Because that, you know, we know that. We say all the time, on the refrigerator at your house, you should have number of medical folks, rehabs, and all that kind of stuff. Because when you're in that crisis situation, you're screwed, basically. Nobody knows.
Yeah, have a plan ready. Right?
Have a plan ready.
I mean, you can always say to Siri, 12-step programs near me.
Definitely.
And that's all. And boom, you'll get like 4, 5, 6, 7, 10, you know, different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you can choose one you'd probably walk to or go to. And I can't imagine somebody in a 12-step program, if you called and said, I'm in trouble, I need help, I couldn't possibly imagine somebody saying, oh, call back later. I mean, it's almost,
it
would never happen.
Yeah.
You know, and so, you know, and it doesn't matter what your addiction is, if you call any 12-step program and say, I'm in trouble, I need help, and they'll say, come to a meeting, and you go to that meeting and say, hi, my name is, I'm in trouble, I need help, they're going to help you. And it's, there's nothing.
But, you know, can I tell you something, Doc? Yeah. I don't think I ever heard of AA when I was in my addiction.
Really?
Yeah. I didn't know what I thought it was a AAA. I don't know what it was, the car service. So I think a lot of people, they just don't know what to do, how to get out of it. And this show was so important that it shows everybody there are options. You can get into therapy. You should get into therapy. You should get into treatment. Whatever you have to do to help yourself.
You know the movie Dr. Sleep, okay? That Danny from the what was the original?
The little guy?
Yeah,
Danny.
Not DeVito.
No.
Who?
Okay, so Dr. Sleep is a sequel.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And Danny grows up, you know, pretty traumatized from his family. And he's the one why am I blocking the name of this most popular movie? Red Rum, you know.
The Shining.
Thank you. There you go.
Thank God.
So The Shining, right, it's a story of Danny who grows up, you know, as the son, the boy that was, you know, possessed, so to speak, or almost possessed. And what I'm bringing this up for a reason, because not the movie, but the actual book. If you actually read Dr. Sleep, it's so impressive with Danny's recovery is in there, And he establishes this relationship with a sponsor. And I have to say, it's one of the most touching stories. Stephen King writes it, and it is a horror story, and it's better than a movie. But he really you could really see the relationship between himself and the sponsor, and how that sponsor and that relationship really pulled him out of his addiction and helped him to really get sobriety.
Wow.
And it's sort of like a, you know, I'm bringing it up because it's sort of a fun way to learn about, like, AA and sponsors.
Check it out, everybody. You know? Yeah. Hey, listen, we're coming up on the hour. Dr. Trigiani, thank you. Will you come back, first of all?
Sure.
This has been fabulous.
He's our resident doctor.
Absolutely. Remember, if you or a loved one is struggling with addiction, help is available. Please call 1-800-662-HELP. For Clean and Sober Radio, I'm Gary Hendler.
I'm Mark Sigmund.
Thank you for listening. To learn more about this broadcast, please join us on our mission at cleanandsoberbroadcasting.com. Thanks, everybody.
The juvenile cells, I hope we pass the audition.
You know that, you know that?